the extent that God taught, like for instance, like by the children that were thrown into the river in Egypt, or the children that were murdered in the Holocaust. Okay? So the thing is that we can know in general God's justice, but the extent that God carries out this justice, that we can't understand, and that we must accept that God is being just, but we can't understand how it is just. That's beyond human. That God did not give us this information. Gentlemen, listen, I am not saying that you should live your whole life to prepare for a Holocaust. I'm saying this is the way you should live your life every day of your life. That you should be searching for truth and watching where the emotions are not in line with that truth and try to straighten it out. That is your life. The only thing is the Holocaust is the highest level of torture that tests you out whether you can do or could help you out in that type of situation. It could help you out because you're in a terrible catastrophe and then your emotions are awakened so you could start dealing with it. I'm not saying you should live for the Holocaust. That's stupid. Okay? You're missing the whole point. I'm only discussing the Holocaust because that was the question that was asked to show you just how it fits into Jewish life. But that's not the purpose of life, is to live for Holocaust. Okay, the purpose of life is to learn, to search for truth, and to get the truth in line with those, to get your emotions in line with that truth. In other words, the idea of trust in God works like this. If your parents, who you trusted, and they did everything for your benefit all your life, they picked you up in the middle of December, in the middle of the night, they picked you up and threw you into the snow. Now, you have to either assume one of two things. Either it's for your benefit, or they went crazy. They're not normal. By God, it's not possible to say he's not normal, so it must be for some benefit. So therefore, we could know that God, that there is a God. We can know, in general, how God relates to us. We can know God's justice. But the thing is, after I know all that, then in the area, it's so real to me, all these ideas are so real to me, so in the area that I can't understand it, namely the extent that God's justice, like why the children, to that extent, that I must trust that God is just based on all my other knowledge, that's where trust comes in. It's not belief based on nothing. You understand? Like I believe everything. It's a belief based on knowledge, where now the knowledge demands that I trust God even where I don't understand him. The question is, should you listen to music? Okay? Regular music, and can it affect you? I don't know, and I don't think that listening to music, you know, like in a car or you're relaxing, I don't think there's anything wrong in that. I do think there is a problem with going to concerts, because the purpose of the concert is to awaken emotions. In other words, why can't you enjoy the music by buying the tape and listening to it? What's the thing about going to the concert? The thing about going to the concert, it raises the level of excitement in the person. And as you raise the level of excitement, that it creates a need to have more and more excitement. And that takes you away from the world of learning. You see? Yeah, it helps extend your fantasy of life. You're trying to get a feeling of excitement, and you're looking for excitement, and that feeling of excitement takes you away from the quiet pleasures. The quiet pleasures, like learning, playing chess or checkers, these are quiet pleasures. There are loud pleasures, which the loud pleasures, they draw you. They awaken new excitement in you, like you go on a roller coaster. It awakens excitement, you see? Those type of pleasures you should try not to partake of, and go to the quiet pleasures that don't awaken the drive for pleasure to a higher level than what you have. This is not a halachic discussion. We're talking about psychologically what is happening. We're not talking about halacha here, okay, whether you're allowed or not allowed, okay? It is not because who the person is that's making the music. That's why I say that you can listen to music on a tape recorder. I mean, you just enjoy the music, okay? But the atmosphere of a concert is for the purpose of awakening a strong excitement, and that excitement lifts the level of your need. You need more and more excitement. It lifts it to a higher level. That is the harm of the concert. Excitement, let's say, for instance, sometimes you listen to music that awakens like a feeling of jumping around or dancing. I mean, people jump around. It's not going to awaken a greater excitement than what you naturally have within you. In other words, you're not extending it to something beyond. You understand? I think the atmosphere of the concert is its whole purpose is to make the great excitement. That's the purpose of the concert. That's the problem. I do not think that an opera or a ballet is going to awaken the excitement.
Where do you draw the line?
What? I don't know if the question is, where do I draw the line? I don't know where I could draw the line. I think it's a decision that each person has to make. Like I said, it's not a question of halacha. It's a question of what's going to bring you to a... Stay where you are. It's going to bring you to a higher level of excitement. You have to make that decision. It's a personal decision that each person has to make. That's really, in all things, is that you have to make a decision. Like, for instance, if you're addicted to chess, so then chess is drawing you into that, and it's taking you away from learning, so then you have to pull away from chess. But if you have a strong need, you're already addicted, or you have a strong need for something, or you feel it will not draw you in, so then you should not. Then you can partake of it. We're not against pleasure; we're against addictions and that which draws you, which draws you towards higher and higher levels of involvement in that pleasure. That's what we're against. So the thing is, each person has to make an evaluation on the different pleasures, and then to be able to partake of those pleasures which do not draw them in, and to try to remove and stay away from to the best of their ability, or to work it through to stay away from those pleasures that draw you in. Okay? Okay, we're discussing money. And the statement was made that money is good only as a means to an end, not an end in itself. There are four ways of relating to money. There's stingy, greed, spendthrift, and the last one we'll call rational. Money doesn't corrupt society. People do. Money doesn't do anything. It's the way people relate to it. And that's what we're going to talk about, these four different relationships to money, so that we could relate to it correctly. But it's for the person to make the decision in the area of relating to money. Stingy means... the difference between stingy and greed is stingy is not spending money. Greed is involved in making money. The question is what is selfishness? Okay? The word selfish is really used anytime you desire to do something. Now, the society separates between two types of selfishness. One is I do something for myself, but when I do for others, that is not selfish. Okay? But however, the truth is, when you do for somebody else, it's based on your conscience. Okay? So therefore, when the conscience is created by some type of authority, And that authority becomes your morality and becomes your responsibility. But it comes from within you, which you have absorbed from some authority, either your parents, society, or school, or whatever. Well, you could pick up even sometimes your clique, your group of friends, become the conscience. And if you act differently than the group, so then you won't be accepted. So therefore, they become the conscience, and you have to live according to them. Okay? So the thing is the truth is everything must be done because of a selfish reason. So therefore, you must always analyze things that the question is it stupid selfishness or intelligent selfishness? Making money is selfish, period. But there's three stupid ways of relating to money and one intelligent way. Okay? And that's what we're discussing. Okay? But the thing is, everybody is selfish. They do it for themselves. Okay? So once again, the difference between stingy and greed is stingy doesn't want to spend money, while greed can't stop making money, and the spendthrift cannot stop spending money. He has to spend money. Now, all these three are irrational, okay? Because there's only a certain amount of money practically that you need. There's a certain amount you have to check out what insurance you should have. What type? How much money does a person practically need in the bank? How much money do you need for the future? So the thing is that there's a certain way of working it out rationally, what your needs are, and then you go for that amount. You see? Beyond that, there is no reason to go. Okay? The one that's rational means I evaluate that money is only a means to have things. Okay? So therefore, if it's only a means to have things, so I have to evaluate all the things that I need, even retirement for the future. If a person enjoys the work he is doing, then fine. Then he does it for the work. And then if he happens to be making a lot of money, fine. There's nothing wrong. I'm not saying there's anything wrong in becoming rich. I'm saying it's how you relate to the money that is the thing. If you relate to it in a practical way, you enjoy what you do, so then there are people in research and they make a lot of money. There's nothing wrong with it. They enjoy it. We're going to discuss today tshuva, repentance. There are two types of mitzvahs, how you relate to it. There's certain type of mitzvahs that it's a matter of forcing yourself to do the act. Like, for instance, let's say a person doesn't wash before he eats. So he has to force himself to wash. He practices so many times, so after a while, he learns to do it. Just a matter of practice. But there's certain things that are totally contrary to a person's personality, and like it's an addiction. Like, for instance, Lashon Hara. Okay? In these cases, you would have to take upon yourself a plan, and I would just like to go over how to make a plan. I'd like to give two areas. One is Lashon Hara, and also I'd like to give an example of smoking. Okay? People that smoke, that are addicted to smoking, I'd like to tell them how to get off. They're not related, they're just two separate, just to get an idea of how to make plans when you have addictions, and I'm just talking about these two addictions, okay? How to make a plan you should get from here, not these two in particular, but when you have an addiction, so you have an approach how to make a plan when you have an addiction, okay? Now, in Lashon Hara, there are a few steps that you have to work on, okay, if you are an addicted to it. Okay? First of all, you have to understand why Lashon Hara is so universal and why there is such an addiction to it. Okay? Lashon Hara, first of all, is only verbal. Many people hold what they say, how could I hurt you? It's only words. You know, words, you know what I mean? It's only words. They relate to words differently than they relate to actions. Actions, they feel, that's evil. But speaking, they don't hold that's evil. It's a harder thing to control, you see, because it's only speaking. Okay? So you have to understand that's one of the reasons why it's so hard, and also it has, we'll soon see that it has a tremendous amount of emotional impact. Many different emotions drive a person to talk Lashon Hara, so we'll have to get into that. But first, the first step that a person has to recognize that is that Lashon Hara is secondary information. Okay? By secondary information, I mean that I got it from somebody else. Now, therefore, if a person tells me Lashon Hara, so the thing is, first of all, does he lie? Does he exaggerate? Does he make mistakes? You know what I mean? Or does he make mistakes about this thing? Or I know he exaggerates about a certain area, so I know where I can trust him and where I can't. This type of analysis would take away a lot of Lashon Hara. And not only that, if he's the fifth person that received the Lashon Hara from the person that started it, I have to know all five people and where they would lie, exaggerate, or make mistakes in all five steps. This would make you realize that Lashon Hara doesn't have a big validity. This is what this would emphasize, that you really can't trust what people say when they speak Lashon Hara. The second step after that is that you have to know in Lashon Hara there's two parts. There is the fact and the interpretation of a fact. Okay? So if you could trust the person and you could accept the fact, the interpretation, you have the right to interpret it differently. Like, for instance, there was a person that there was something wrong and he lost control and he fell, and there was a doctor. Okay? And the doctor examined him and you know, he gave his told the guy what to do, but then he wrote to this guy's he wrote a letter to this guy's doctor, and his doctor says, I have to accept his facts. He's a physician that was there at that time and that place, and I have to accept the physician's facts of what happened, but I don't accept his interpretation. You understand? I have a different interpretation based on the facts that he wrote. I have a different interpretation. So therefore, interpretation is dependent on the facts. You understand? So therefore, you have a right to separate between the interpretation and the interpretation and the facts. Even if I do accept the facts, I can analyze it. Do I accept these facts? Do I accept this interpretation? Okay? This will eliminate a lot of more Lashon Hara, because you might have different interpretations. That's not so bad. The next step in Lashon Hara is to recognize, like, let's say, for instance, somebody talks Lashon Hara about somebody's clothing, the way they dress. Okay? Now, if you're putting down a person for the way they dress, is this your value system? That you condemn and judge people based on dress? Or is your value system that you judge people based on their chachma, on their wisdom, or their justice, or evil? You understand? That's terrible what it says about you, your value system. A lot of Lashon Hara, if you listen to it, it speaks terrible of the value system of the person that's speaking it. I mean, you have to recognize when you condemn somebody for something, that's your value system. You see? So the question is that your value system? That you talk Lashon Hara about how a person plays sports or the way they dress? I mean, that's not good or evil, so he doesn't play so well. And that's the reason to put him down? Is that your value system? You see? That's the next thing. The last thing is all the different emotions. There are many, many emotions involved. There's, you talk Lashon Hara because of jealousy, vengeance. You talk Lashon Hara because of the ego. You put people down, so they're down, therefore I'm up. You see, if I put them down, then I feel good, then I'm above them, because I'm putting them down. And so then all these ideas first have to be analyzed and understood logically, and then to see how it fits into your, in other words, you have to define what is jealousy, what is vengeance, how does it work, why is vengeance not justice, what is justice? People usually confuse justice with vengeance, you see? So therefore, you have to analyze vengeance in that way. You have to do a thorough analysis in all these areas. That is one type of plan, okay? Another type of plan is if somebody is addicted to smoking. The first step that they would have to do is if you have an addiction to smoking, it would be a good idea to understand how the addiction comes about, what causes it. I'm not talking, I know there's a physical part to it that you become attached to it, but that you can't do anything about. You have to do the psychological part. What in general causes people psychologically to become so attached to smoking? That would be one thing, okay? I'm not going to discuss the psychological thing. I mean, that the person will have to wait, deal with. I'm just working on the plan. Okay, so I don't want to get into details of the psychological. That'd be a discussion in and of itself. The second thing would be is to start a scrapbook on all the articles that he could find or that he could get his hands on about the harm of smoking. You see, all the different harms of smoking, and review that idea, let's say once a week, once a month. Doesn't have to be every day, you know, to review those ideas, but not for the purpose of accepting authority. That won't help too much. But if you can understand how it works, even if you have to speak to a doctor, the more clear it is how it works and how it affects the body, how smoke affects the body, once you start analyzing that, so then it becomes more real, the damage that smoking does, you see? So that reality will help you fight to go against the idea of to go against smoking. And with that, you'd be able to beat smoking. So this is the type of plan that if you want to repent on these type of addictions, you want to undo these type of addictions, then the way to do it is you can't, sometimes you could, you can force yourself to stop. But sometimes you can't. It becomes very difficult. You need a plan, whatever your addiction is that you want to deal with, you first must get a plan to how to deal with that addiction in the manner that we showed these two. The question is, people want to accept the Torah and the story of creation. They would like to accept it literally. So they say, when it says 6 days, God created the world in six 24-hour periods. Okay? Even though there were no 24 hours before the fourth day, because the earth and the sun were not created yet. Okay? So therefore, that doesn't seem to bother them. Okay? But so how come in evolution we find bones of dinosaurs and that we see that it's millions and billions of years old? So what do you do with the science? So they said God made it that way. He made it as if it was ready made. He created it in 7 days, but he made it look like it was as if it was 12 billion years old. Okay? That is what this certain people say. And to these people, they hold that when the Torah says a day, it means a 24-hour period. They take the word literally. So the question is, according to physics, many things don't fit into 7 days. It's more like millions and billions. So therefore, they say that God made the world in 6 days, but he made it look like millions and billions of years. Okay? That is their view. The reason why I don't accept that, even assuming God did it that way, but because of science practically, I must accept, in other words, even they accept that if you looked at the physical world, it's as if it's 12 billion years old, right? Which means that practically that there's no difference than if you said, in other words, if the world was 12 billion or not 12 billion, since God created it to look like 12 billion, so therefore I must accept the fact that it's 12 billion years old. You understand? Whether God... But practically, I must accept these facts. And they themselves are accepting these facts. The only thing is, they say it looks that way. So practically, is there any difference between if it looks that way or really happens? No. The fact is that's the way it is. So practically, insofar as the practical is concerned, there's no practical difference. Ultimately, what God did, I don't know. I have to look at it the way God wanted me to look at it. Since he created it, it looks like it's ready made according to them, so I have to assume it's ready made. I mean, I have to assume that it took a long time for it to come about. There is a practice on Yom Kippur to wear white, okay? And people say that the reason is that it's equal to the grave. Like you, at the time of burial, you should think in the time of being buried. Okay? And the question is, why should I think about being buried? What are they trying to just frighten me? I mean, why do I have it? It's a minhag to wear white. It's not not everybody's obligated to wear white, but it's a minhag to wear white, and some people give the reason as the reason because it should be like the grave. Like it should be like the day of death. So the question is they trying to frighten us? What's the reason? Where did this practice come about? What's the benefit of the practice? Another question that I'd like to ask is, on Yom Kippur, what are the purposes of the different prayers? What are they supposed to do? In general, the piyutim, the poems and different things that they say, by the reviewing by Chazaras Hashat, where they review the Shmona Esrei. So the question is, what is the purpose of those prayers? Especially like where you bang by your heart, you say, I sin. What are the purpose of these prayers? Now the thing is the question is like this. In other words, this is a list of all the sins that a person could have done in some fashion or some form, right? Now, when you do these things, so what do? You check it off. You say, well, yeah, I sinned. I spoke Lashon Hara. I had a Yetzera. It's like a list that you check off and you enumerate all the things that you did. Is that the purpose of these prayers? The thing is that it's really the time for decision. It's really Yom Kippur is a time of decision, a big decision, that I'm going to make changes in my life. It's not a matter of enumerating or recognizing that I did something, but it's a matter of saying that, yeah, I did something wrong. That's the first step, is recognizing. So really, Yom Kippur is really a day of decision, and it's a decision of I'm going to change my life, and the question is how. Now, very few people could change all the sins that they did overnight, so you're going to have to make a decision what takes priority, what you're going to do, how you're going to do it. There has to be some type of a plan. What you're going to do, there has to be, so it all has to be worked out. There's a decision, you have to work it out. Okay? So it's not just enumerating, reading the prayers, just to enumerate what you did, but it's a matter of getting you to think about, to decide on what you're going to do and which ones you're going to take care of, and to create a plan for the rest of the year to start working on making a change in your life. Okay? Is that clear? Okay. Now, when a person makes a decision in life, it's very important that he gets different views. Okay? So, sometimes you discuss it with a friend, sometimes you discuss it with a teacher. I've sometimes discussed things with students to make a decision, to hear different views, because people look at it from a different angle, so it's good to get a different view. Okay? Let's say, for instance, you have to make a decision, let's say, about washing your hands before eating, right? Yeah. Before you eat bread, right? Now, the thing is that the way you look at it now is, well, yeah, it's an important thing, but I'm a little lazy, you know. I don't feel like doing it right now. Or for tzedakah. Let's say, for instance, you take upon yourself the obligation to give tzedakah. So then, well, yeah, but I need the money for this, I need the money for that. That's one view of looking at it, right? Let's say you were on your deathbed. How would you look at it then? How would you look at tzedakah then?
Very modestly.
Yes, you wouldn't think about that I'm too cheap to give it to somebody else.
It almost makes you righteous when you can.
In other words, it changes, it's like getting a different view of the same subject. In other words, on your deathbed, you're not going to say, well, I said 1,000,000 pieces of Lashon Hara. I ruined 10 lives by doing it. I mean, you know what I mean? You're not going to think, you know what I mean? You're going to try to deny that. You're not going to think about that, you see? So when you look at life from death, it's a different view than looking at life looking forward. When you're looking forward, there's the desire to do the right thing, but then there's the emotion pulling you the other way, you see? But when you're on your deathbed, you don't have the emotion pulling you the other way. You can look at it objectively. So when we dress in the shrouds of a dead person, it's to help us and to make us realize that we should look at life from a different angle than the present life, so that it will help you make a more objective decision about doing tshuva, about repenting, about changing your life. Because that's what you're really doing. You're making a decision, a very big decision, about life. You see? So therefore, since you're making a decision about life, we want you to look at it from different aspects. Sometimes you can speak it over with somebody, but sometimes in your own mind, you can look at it in two different aspects. First aspect is how you feel now. Well, now you're in conflict. You want to do the right thing, but there's powerful emotions, you know? But on the other hand, if you look at it from the area of death, how are you going to look at yourself when you're on your deathbed, you see, then it'll become very objective. And if you have a totally different view, it'll help you make your decision in making the decision about repenting. The question is that what if I don't wear white? So what happens then? Okay? The answer is that the idea of white is supposed to remind you of this idea, which we just discussed. If you have a minhag or a practice not to wear white, that doesn't mean you should not think of this idea. You don't have to wear the white, but you should. But the idea is still there. Those people that have accepted upon themselves this practice, I'm saying that the purpose of the practice, that people wear white on Rosh Hashanah and especially on Yom Kippur, the reason is to identify with a person on his deathbed, so that you should have a different view. Now, this idea you could have, even if somebody else is wearing white, it could remind you of it. Or even if nobody is wearing white, you should still think of this idea. And this idea is not only good on Yom Kippur, but this idea is good all year round too, that you could think this way. Even all year round, the person, when he has to make a big decision, should stop to think that way, because it helps remove that part of you that emotionally doesn't want to do the correct act. So it helps you to look at it from a different angle. Okay? That's the only purpose of that. That's my understanding of the white that people wear. But you don't have to wear it if that's not your minhag. It's a separate thing. But the idea is a good idea, and the idea is a good idea all year round. In other words, even if you do it all year round and you think in this way all year round and you even change your life during the year, you still need to keep Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, first of all, because God said that you should do it this way. But secondly, there's a benefit because it emphasizes this idea, and sometimes people start forgetting. Like, for instance, Pesach represents a certain idea, represents education, freedom. Sukkot represents another idea. The different holidays, different things that we do represent different ideas. So that you put more emphasis on these 10 days on tshuva, to think about tshuva. You see? So then you get more information. It helps you the whole year. But then, this is not the end knowledge of Yom Kippur. There's more knowledge. And you see, you study it, there's books on it, there's, besides the Marzer, there's books on the Marzer, interpreting the Marzer. You understand? And it's, and these things help you to get depth and understanding. I'm just talking about one aspect of Yom Kippur. I think it's an essential aspect, that you're making a decision to change your life. That is the purpose. Okay? Now, there's a lot of details, and this is just to help you one idea. But then there's a lot of ideas, so you emphasize it on Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, you bring it out, it affects you the whole year. Pesach, you'll study about Pesach, the idea of Pesach. Now, you put a lot of emphasis on the idea of Pesach around Pesach, and then it'll help you the whole year. But it's a reminder and also a time to go in deeper and a broader understanding of the subject that these holidays are teaching us. Some things like prayer. You need to be reminded, like Shimon Esrei, three times a day. Shema is twice a day. You understand? You understand? So therefore, Ashrei is so important, you say it three times a day. It's reminding you of a very important idea. Some things only need to be reminded for 7 days once a year. Or the tshuva is 10 days once a year. So the thing is, it depends what it is. It's different ideas that you need constant reminder and to go over and to go more in depth. A while back on this tape, we were talking about rock concerts, whether you should go to it or about in general, about how different pleasures draw you. Now, the thing is that the idea of Yom Kippur is you have to make decisions not only on Yom Kippur, but every day of the year. Now, therefore, whether you're going to have a certain pleasure, you have to know how it's going to affect you. Okay? I mean, if you're going to smoke, let's say, for instance, there's a high probability that it's going to draw you and cause an addiction. Is it worth starting something that is going to cause an addiction? You see, you have to, even though all your friends might be doing it or might seem desirable, you see, you have to make an evaluation. You see? So therefore, the thing is that people, that's also Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur means that you have to decide to train yourself on how to make decisions. You see? That's also about Yom Kippur, to making decisions. You have to evaluate what to do in everyday life. Now, in my view, music usually doesn't draw you. It's usually like background while you're driving. Some people like it while they're studying. There was a Rosh Yeshiva that while he was learning, he used to listen to classical music. He used to have classical music blasting while he was studying Torah. Some people, while they're studying, they like music. I don't see where it draws them into being addictive to it. But however, I do see a concert, the purpose of the concert is to raise your emotion to a very high level. Okay, so the question is what's wrong with raising your emotions to a very high level? Okay? There was I think it was a soccer team, an American soccer team that were playing the Russians during the Olympics, and the odds were totally against them. They should have lost. And they won. The American team.
Okay.
Somebody, yeah, right, right. So, okay. So the thing is that they were, I mean, it was unbelievable, the excitement. And around 10 years later, a reporter went back to visit these people to see how they were. The people that participated, that won, the Americans that won. Okay? Most of them were very unhappy because they had such a high that life could not afford them that high, and they felt a certain unhappiness, a certain loss. Some of them tried to get that high back. A very high, a very high in excitement. I'm not against excitement, but where it draws you to such a height, that experience gives you the desire to reach that experience again. And then you become unhappy when you don't. So therefore it can ruin your life. But what happens is it draws you, you want to do it again and again to try and reach that high again, and you're ruined. That's the addiction, that you're trying to reach that high. You become addicted to it, you can't get out of it. And you can never reach that high. I'm not talking about where you guys play basketball, you know, you play, go out and have fun and play basketball. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about where you put your life into it, and then you reach that epitome of life. You put years in it. Then once you reach that high, then you must constantly do it again, to try again and again to reach that high, and that in itself becomes an addiction. The question is about on Erev Yom Kippur, there's a minhag to, right, so we want to discuss the reason, the practice. There's certain people that have a minhag or a practice to put a chicken around your head, to swing it around your head three times, and you say that he should go, like you say during that time, you say that he should go to death and not me. Okay, and the question is why we do this Erev Yom Kippur. Okay, and then it becomes, then they slaughter it according to halacha, and then sometimes they give it to the poor, you can eat it yourself, whatever it is. But however, the question is, what's the reason for the minhag? Okay? There's also another minhag that we discussed earlier on the tape, about why some people wear white in shul. They wear white on Yom Kippur, and it's supposed to, well, it looks like a sheet, right? And the thing is that it's also supposed to remind you of the dead, because we bury the dead in white sheets, so it's supposed to remind you of the death. Okay. I'm giving the same reason that I gave before for the why you make the chicken around your head, as I did before for wearing the shrouds, okay, the white shrouds. So the same thing with the chicken. Human beings identify with animals, and you see your own reaction. When we talk about you saw the chicken and then it died, so you feel grossed out. Why? Because you identify with the animal. So it awakens a certain identification with the animal that's going to die. So it puts you in the framework, as because since you identify with it, so it puts you in the framework of being able to look at life from the point of death. You see? And once you look at life on the deathbed, it's a very different view than when you look at life, forward looking at life for all the things you desire and all the things you want. So that different perspective will help you make a decision, about life. So therefore, since Yom Kippur is a day of decision, the day that you have to make decisions to change your life, so we want to give you the perspective of looking at it from that angle, so that you can make correct decisions with removing all the. Then you have the idea of a different view without all the desires. Looks at it without the desires, so you could look at it more objectively. That is the purpose of the different practices that try to get you to look at face death as if you're on your deathbed, and to because you have to make decisions that are very important decisions, and this method should be used all year round too. It should not only be used on Yom Kippur, but whenever you have to make an important decision, this is a good method to test out yourself in making decisions, to look at it from two perspectives, from the perspective of your desires now, and from the perspective of how you look at it from the deathbed. In the Chazaras HaShatz, in the review of Shmon Esrei on Yom Kippur, okay, they have the tefillah that we're going to do some chumash. It's in Shemot, Perek Aleph, chapter 10, chapter 1, verse 10, and it's the Sefurnos commentary. Okay, as you know, Paro called a cabinet meeting, and he said there is a problem about the Jews, because there's so many of them that they'll join our, if there's a time of war, they'll join our enemies, and when they join our enemies, they'll destroy us, okay, and they'll go up from the land, okay? So the Sfuno says, why did they think that the Jews were their enemies, okay? Why did the Egyptians think that the Jews were enemies? He says, because the Jews were different. How are they different? One is they had circumcision. They still spoke their own language, Hebrew. And they had different customs. Okay? And he quotes back to Bereishis where it says, by Yosef, where the brothers came to visit Yosef, it says over there that the Egyptians were not able to eat with the Hebrews. Okay? So with these people, because they were different. So because they were different, they couldn't eat together. According to Egyptian religion, they could not eat together. So he says, the Svuna says, since they are different, they are definitely, he says, without a doubt, they're definitely our enemies. That's what the Egyptian says, because we're different. But it'll only show up that they're our enemies. It doesn't show up now. It'll be revealed that they're enemies when there's a war, and the Jews will join the enemy to destroy the Egyptians. Okay? Is everybody clear what the Sefuno says? Yeah. So the thing is, I want to say that life has not changed for the Jew since that time. In other words, one of the causes of anti-Semitism, what the Sefuno is talking about, is one of the causes of anti-Semitism is that when a person is different, bigotry comes about when a person is different. Color of your skin, your religion, your customs, the way you live your life, any superficial thing is based on bigotry. I mean, bigotry is based on any superficial thing. And a bigot holds that this person is his enemy by virtue that he is different. So he says that anti-Semitism came about by virtue that Judaism operates differently than any other nation. And because of that, that's the way the anti-Semitism was in that time, from the time we were in Egypt, and today also, it's not much different about the bigotry and the anti-Semitism against the Jew. We're doing Proverbs chapter 10, verse 19. It says, with much words, a person cannot stop from sinning. And he who prevents his lips or stops his lips is a thinker. Okay? So they said that if A person is just talking without thinking, then after a while he's going to start gossiping. Okay? Now the question is why. Okay? So far what we said was, is that the basic nature of human is to be evil. Okay? So therefore, if he talks without thinking, then that evil part will come out. Like, for instance, his angers, his jealousies, his vengeance. So it will, at some point, show up if he just if he doesn't stop to think before he speaks. All right. To clarify, in other words, since the base nature is evil, in other words, so therefore, if you are ignorant, then evil must come out. The only way you could change evil is with knowledge. Knowledge is... ignorance is evil. There's no question about that. Christianity says forgive them because they do not know what they're doing. We do not hold from that. If you are ignorant, that is evil. Okay? Therefore, a person should prevent or stop to think before he speaks. That's basically what the proverb is saying. Pure silver is the tongue of the righteous, and the heart of the wicked is small. The pure silver is the tongue of the righteous, and the heart of the wicked is small. And the first question is that the comparison doesn't make sense. Okay? Because if you're going to compare the tongue, first of all, talking about the tongue, meaning speech, the heart means, in those times, a lot of people say the heart means the mind, okay? So talking about two different things. And if it's making a comparison, why does it say his heart is small? Then the opposite should be the heart is big. And if you're saying that it's pure silver, then it should be, the opposite should be silver with dross. But it doesn't say that. I mean, the comparison doesn't seem to work out. And the question is, what is the metaphor of pure silver? And the question is, small, what does it mean? I mean, small what? We don't know what we're talking about. All right? All right, so the first thing I think that we have to do is take the metaphor of pure silver. The first question that we have to ask is, whenever you try to make a comparison, you should have the opposite. So the opposite is silver with dross. Okay? In other words, when you mine silver, when you first take it out of the mine, it's mixed with many other metals. And then there's a process of refining it where you take out the other metals and then you make it pure. Okay? That is the process of refining silver. Okay? Right. The first thing one of our students says is that pure silver represents the righteous goes through processes of purifying his emotions, and that would follow very well from the last verse that we're talking about. The last verse is talking about a beginner, so he has evil, he hasn't purified himself. So the best advice we could give to him is don't talk, try and start only when it's absolutely necessary, but don't just allow yourself to go rambling on, because evil will come out. But however, a person that has worked, that's why they call that person a thinker. Now we're talking about the tzaddik, a tzaddik who's worked on refining his speaking, so then he could speak, and he's not worried about bad things coming out. So the question is, but that comes from the mind, it should be that pure silver is the mind of the tzaddik. Okay? That was the question asked. Okay? The answer to that is that the subject is speech, and the thing is true, the refining process is in the mind. The refining process must be in the mind. Now when you speak that which is on your mind. So therefore, a person that refined his thoughts and removed the dross, he could start talking, because even if he rambles, his rambling will go in the direction of chokhmah, of wisdom. because he worked it out. But the first, comparing it to the last verse, but the first type of person, if he rambles on, his base nature is to talk evil. So therefore, this is the second step where a person must, after he has refined, after he went through a process of working through and refined, so then he could start talking, because he'll naturally talk wisdom. And the heart of the wicked is small means, now the thing is, it must be related back to the first half of the verse. And since the first half of the verse is talking about the ideas of the tzaddik, the purity of the tzaddik, in other words, his ideas are based on justice and chokmah, how to live, and wisdom, right? So the Rasha could have a little bit of this. He's not totally devoid, not all the time, is he totally devoid of something good. Is it could be sometimes a little bit of good that is there. That has the idea of truth in it. In other words, his basic personality is evil, but he still has the mind, and there is a sense of reality in that mind. You see? And that sense of reality is a little bit. As long as he has that, there's a chance of tshuva. Once that little bit is removed, if he takes a step over the line, that little bit is removed, it's all over. The question is that could the wicked change? If he has that little bit in him, then there's a chance that that little bit could be brought out. Given the right circumstances, it could be brought out and he could change. Okay? But once that little bit is gone, then there's no hope for him. That's it. There's no way of him repenting. It's over with. Okay, during the Yom Kippur prayer, it says there's a slicha that says like this, like the clay in the hand of the potter. We're talking about we in the hand of God. Like the clay in the hand of the potter, he expands it at will and contracts it at will. So are we in your hand, O preserver of kindness. Look to the covenant and ignore the accuser. Then he goes on, like the stone in the hand of the cutter, he grasps it at will and smashes it at will. So are we in your hand, O source of life and death. Okay, and he goes on to a few other metaphors like that. All right, so the question is what is the idea, not the particulars of every different metaphor, what is the idea in general? And the question is it talking only about Jews or in general of mankind? Okay? I guess that we'll find out after we interpret the metaphor. You know what I mean? I really don't know. The thing is like this. The question is what is your responsibility in this world, and where is God's responsibility take over? Okay? Borderline. Okay? Basically, our sages say, Hakol bidei shemayim chutz miyiras shemayim. Everything is in the hands of heaven except the fear of heaven. Meaning that the only thing that you have is free will. After free will, you can try to carry out what you want to do, but whatever you do is the result of whether you'll be able to carry it out is not in your hands. The only thing that is in your hands is action, not results. Results is in the end. You strive towards the result, but however, the result is in God's hands. For instance, let's say you want to come. You want to go someplace, you have to cross the bridge. Well, if the bridge broke, that's it. It's out of your hands. You can't get across. You can't do what you wanted to do. There's things in the physical world that stop you from doing what you wanted to do. Okay? So therefore, when you realize that everything is in God's hands, that and all results are in God's hands, so therefore, here on Yom Kippur, you are making a decision that the only way you could get the things that you want is only through God. When you realize that, then you realize that it's that if you want to get anything, is the way to be, to do tshuva, to start being in line with God's will, and to do God's will. Okay, so that's what I wanted to say. What this means. Therefore, the answer to their first question is that yes, it would apply to all people. All people, whatever they want, they could turn to God, even non-Jews. Okay. Rabbi C.B. Weiss gave a different explanation. Okay. Rabbi Weiss wanted to say that if you look carefully at the metaphor, is that God, the metaphor is that a craftsman changes the object to whatever he wants. He can do whatever he wants to the object. If he likes it, he could form it in a certain way. If he doesn't, he could smash it or do whatever he wants. So what it's saying is that this world is based on God's plan. Okay? The world, the reason why God made the world, because he had a certain plan for the universe. Okay? And the thing is that whether you act in accordance with that plan or not in accordance with that plan, God's plan will occur. You see? So therefore, what you should do is you should do tshuva so that you should be in line with God's plan, because God's plan is going to happen. It would be equal, like for instance, let's say for instance, you want to knock a mountain down and you take a shovel and you start, you know, shoveling out the sand. I mean, it's just not going to happen. You understand? That's what it is, going against God's will. You understand? Let's say human being wants to fly, he jumps off a bridge. You understand? It's just not going to happen. He's not going to fly. The same thing, trying to go against God's will, it's just not going to work. It just doesn't work. You understand? So when you understand that, so then you realize that you cannot accomplish anything except God's will. So once you realize that reality, so then you'll do tshuva and be in line with God's will. Those are the two views. All right, the first question is, I got an email, and the first question is why is the Mashiach so central to Judaism that it warrants its being one of the 13 principles? That is the question. In other words, the 13 Animamans have to do with God. It has to be an understanding of God somehow, or how God works, or how God relates to us. But that's the 13 basic principles. It's a relationship to God. Okay? So the question is, how does Mashiach clarify the idea of God? Or how God relates to us? Okay. The thing is that in most, throughout history, you find that that basically the governments were run by evil. It's run by evil, and since it's run by evil, so therefore you have to live the Torah system despite the government you're under. Okay? There were few breathers throughout the ages, and those breathers were places where we could actually live the religion according to the way we can, but otherwise we basically run under evil. Okay? The Mashiach represents the idea that the system at one point will be running perfectly, and you'll be able to see God's system working perfectly. In other words, when the government is run based on God's system, so then you'll be able to see how the system runs, so that helps you have a relationship to God. This idea, even today, you could understand how God's system works if you understand the ideas, and you understand the ideas of justice, you understand the ideas of halacha and how it works. So then you will see that the you'll be able to see, in other words, through the mind, you'll be able to see the system working perfectly. You understand that it's a perfect system, and you'll see exactly how it's a perfect system. But however, at the time of the Mashiach, the perfect system will be actually working. Well, the next question that he asked was that if you have two or three of the principles, of the 13 principles, once you understand those ideas, the others are included in these two or three. So the question is why do you need all 13? You could have two or three, and if you have those two or three principles, all the other 13 will fit in. Why do you need 13? That is the question. In other words, he could have mentioned the two or three principles, and then he could have explained how these particulars fit into those two or three principles. But all you'd have to know is the two or three principles, and the rest would fit in, the details. I mean, I'm not saying you can't write the details, but the basics would be the two or three that everything would fit into. Now, the Rambam who wrote the 13 holds that you see, the thing is, it is true philosophically. If you knew the concept behind the 13, you would be able to get all 13 from two or three principles. But however, since this was written for the public might not be able to understand how to get from the principles, or they might the details. You understand? They see the principles, but they don't know how to figure out the details because they're not trained that way. So since the 13 is written for Klal Yisrael, every one must be proven from the Torah. The Rambam quotes a pasuk for every one of the 13 so that people could get it straight from the Torah, even though they're not sophisticated in their thinking process, and therefore they would not be able to get or understand the details based on these three. So therefore he wrote the 13 based on Torah because of the people that are not sophisticated, so they could relate to God completely, even though they're not that sophisticated in the world of study. Alright, the question is like this: how can humility be a positive attribute when it makes one feel so lonely? This question is clearly pointing towards a more fundamental issue, but I'm not sure what that is. That is the question. The question that everybody's asking: does humility lead to loneliness? That's the question. The next question is that if humility is, which most people think it is, that humility is lower than what you are, so then humility is humility itself would be a bad trait, because you're looking at life incorrectly. The question is loneliness a bad trait? The thing is that it's true you feel bad when you're lonely, but just because you feel bad, that doesn't mean it's a bad trait. It might be a good trait. Okay? So that is another question that we're asking. The first question that I'd like to take is humility. Okay? The question is, what is humility? Now, there's two views of humility. The first view of humility is a bad self-image, that I think of myself lower than what I am. Now, the way a bad self-image comes about is that I create a goal which is beyond which I could reach, and I strive for it, and since I cannot make it, I feel that there's something wrong with me. In other words, there's such a thing called the conscience. What the conscience does, it creates a level which obligates you to that level, and when you cannot fulfill that level, so then you feel that something's wrong with you, and that you're not living up to par, so you have a bad, that's the way you get a bad self-image. Okay? That is not humility. That's a bad self-image. Okay? And that has to be cured. we would hold that the first thing, before you can get humility, is to cure your bad self-image. Now, what happens when you have a bad self-image, you feel you are not accepted by certain authorities. In other words, depending how you get the bad self-image. In other words, let's say, for instance, you hold your group that you are becomes the way of evaluating yourself, that you fit into that group. And then you do something out of line of that group, so then that becomes your conscience, that group becomes your conscience, and therefore you feel that you are on the lowest, therefore you get a bad self-image that way, and therefore you are isolated from the group. Even, we're not talking about in reality. We're not talking about reality. We're talking about the mind or the emotions of the person that has this type of bad self-image. They feel isolated from whoever they recognize as the authority that dictates what is the correct thing to do. And once they recognize that authority, and if they're not up to par, so then they have a bad self-image. They have and also simultaneously, they're separated from this group, so there's a feeling of loneliness. In other words, let's say your parents expect of you to have straight A's, and you can't keep up the straight A's. I mean, you just can't, right? So then you have a bad self-image, right? But simultaneously that you have the bad self-image, you also feel you're not living up to your parents. You're isolated from your parents. You're separated from your parents. You feel lonely. It has nothing to do with reality. It has to do with the way you feel. Sometimes the unconscious part of you, is working totally irrationally on how it evaluates itself. But basically, this premise is the way it works. Bad self-image comes about, and the feeling of loneliness. You could be in a crowd and still feel lonely. You see? That feeling of loneliness is not in reality, and it comes about through the... I'm not saying this is the only way loneliness comes about. That I don't know. There might be other ways that loneliness comes about. But I'm saying this is one of the ways that loneliness would come about. Now, the question is whether loneliness is a good thing. Definitely this type of loneliness is not good. It's just a false view of yourself. It's a result of a false view of yourself. But there is a feeling of loneliness when you are physically separated. Whether that's bad or good, it depends how you deal with it. I mean, you could say, well, I'm lonely, I'm by myself, so maybe I'll sit and learn Torah. So then the loneliness was a good thing. The physical loneliness is what you do with it, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing. Like anything in this world, it's how you deal with the physical world is not good or bad. The human being that deals, how he deals with it is good or bad. So how you deal with the actual reality of being alone, that's up to each person, that's their decision, how they work it out. But the emotion of loneliness that comes from a bad self-image, you see, that feeling of loneliness is definitely a painful thing, and it's of no value. Something that has to be undone. That which the person that asked this question in his email, he said, this question is clearly pointing towards a more fundamental issue. Okay, that fundamental issue is what is the definition of humility? Since we just removed the bad self-image as a definition of humility, so now we need a new definition for humility. Humility is simply a recognition of reality, where you have the ability to recognize reality. In other words, a recognition of reality and a recognition of your place in reality. In other words, when you study reality, in other words, like an example, let's say you study astronomy, right? You see the vastness of the universe. Well, then you realize you're not more than a piece of sand, like a piece of sand on the beach. I mean, compared to the universe. So you just recognize that there's not importance, not a bad self-image. In other words, you recognize who you are. Moshe Rabbeinu knew that he knew more than anybody else. Moshe Rabbeinu had to know that he was closer to God than anybody else. But now he's faking himself out. That would be a bad self-image. He's not dealing... That's bad self-image means I don't have a real view. But I recognize that whatever I do, when I study the universe, and especially the Moshe Rabbeinu who knew God in comparison to God, so therefore he recognized that whatever he does could only be practical. There is no success, like something great, like I did something great. The only thing that is really left for the person of humility is enjoyment and practicality. But the greatness is removed. The idea of greatness is removed. You see? But he's practical and he recognizes the practicality of who he is and what he does. He sees reality for what it is. Yes. So Zach wants to say it's not a bad self-image that we're against. We're against an incorrect image of yourself, either lower or higher. Both of them are incorrect, and it makes you view life incorrectly, and you draw incorrect conclusions because of the image. Okay? Humility means I don't operate by this type of image of myself. I just operate in reality. In reality, there's only two things. There's enjoyment and practicality. That's it. So I either try for enjoyment, whatever I enjoy, or I deal with the practicality. By practicality, I mean I have to make a living. You know what I mean? I have to be careful that I shouldn't have too many enemies, because you could be hurt by that. You know, different practical things. That's Mishlei. Mishlei deals with the practical life. In other words, there is no such thing as greatness. Moshe Rabbeinu did what was necessary for him to do. He saw it as his responsibility, or insofar as his learning, that he enjoyed the world of ideas, so he enjoyed those ideas, and insofar as he ran Klal Yisrael, he saw it as his... that he was obligated to do this. This was his job. And therefore he looked at it as a very practical thing, doing the will of God. You see? So that's the way he looked at it. In other words, by humility we take away a false self-image whether low self-image or high self-image, but it's a false image. And you remove imagery totally. That's why you see it's a good self-image or a bad self-image. We remove image. You do not have an image of yourself. You just look at yourself realistically. The image is removed. Alright, we're dealing with idolatry, okay? And the question is, how does idolatry come about? Okay? So, the thing is that let's say you say a certain tree has power. Okay? Now you really feel there's a powerful emotion that it's real. You'll give it gold, you'll give it whatever you project onto it, you feel this thing has power. Okay? Now the question is, where did it get that power? The answer is that it has to be in your mind, this power, that it has this power. Right? So now the thing is that you must have an image of yourself that you have certain powers that are outside of reality. You must have it. You must. Yeah, the person that's creating the god, the person that's creating the idol, you see, must have that feeling in himself to project it out. If he doesn't have it in himself, where did it come from? It didn't come from reality, because it's not real. So it projects a certain power that he has that he feels in himself, but if he actually saw that, he'd be psychotic. I mean, he'd feel he's a god. To feel you're a god, you have to be psychotic. So therefore, this is the closest thing to becoming psychotic enough and being accepted without really being psychotic. In other words, you create a power in this physical thing that really doesn't exist there, but it really must come from someplace, so it must come from you. The only way you can project something onto something or somebody else is you must have those feelings in yourself. That is the meaning of projection. So to create a power in another object means that you must feel that power within yourself. But the only thing is you can't face it, so you project it out onto something else. Just a little clarification on that. In other words, if you project out onto a tree that it is that it has supernatural powers, that's further from reality than a person that projects out onto somebody that he's jealous. In other words, let's say I'm jealous and I don't want to face that jealousy, and I project that onto somebody else that they're jealous. That's not as far away from reality as the person that projects powers onto others. In other words, the idea is the same, but however, it's just a question of what level of how much reality you have. That's the question. You understand? In other words, the mechanism is the same. The mechanism of projection is the same in both. It's just a different level of how far from reality you are. In other words, that's why our sages say that if you talk Lashon Hara, it's equal to the three worst sins, one of them being idolatry, and because it has the same mechanism as idolatry. Okay, we're doing Mishlei Perek Yud, Pasuk, chapter 10, verse 21. And it says, "The lips of the righteous shepherd many, and the fools with their lack of heart, they die." Well, first of all, I'd like to clarify that by chasar lev, lack of heart, means lack of thought, without thinking. The fool, without thinking, so they will die. Okay, the question is, why will they die? And the question is, what does it mean, shepherd? Okay, shepherd is, it's like a metaphor here. Shepherd, right? So we have to understand the metaphor first. According to the Mitzvah Tzion, shepherd means he causes the sheep to eat. He brings them to pasture and brings them their needs. Right? That is how the Mitzvah Tzion interprets the metaphor of shepherding. Now the question is, how does that fit into the verse? Right. A righteous person, when he deals with others, he tries to help them satisfy their needs. That is the job of the righteous. Okay? In helping others, he tries to make sure he satisfies their needs. Okay? So that's the first half of the verse. Okay? Second half of the verse, question is why is that the job of the righteous to give the needs of the people? To guide them for their needs. Just like the shepherd leads the sheep to pasture, so he guides them to satisfy their needs. Why does that fall under the category of righteousness? What is the definition of righteousness that would bring about that his obligation is to take care of the needs of others, or guide them to their needs, to help them get their needs? A just person is a person that wants to make sure that the system works, that there's a system, and the people to relate to each other must live with the system. And the purpose of a system is so that each person should be should have their needs and then satisfy the needs of others. First have their own needs then satisfy the needs of others. That is the way a system works, that people interreact. The just person tries to make sure that the system works. So therefore, if a person is not being satisfied, then the system is not working. So it becomes his job to help him out and to guide him so that the system should work. Now the question is, what does the second half of the verse have to do with the first half? I mean, the opposite should be that the fools don't help others. Instead it said that here it talks about the fool himself, that the fool, because of his lack of thought, they will die. The fools will die. Okay? So how does that relate to the first half of the verse? And the answer is that the righteous person, since he's working with the system, he understands what is, in other words, if I'm going to help somebody with their needs, then I must understand my own needs. So the verse is saying not only does the righteous take care of himself, but he takes care of his others also. Not only does he take care of his own life, but he takes care of others. While the fool cannot even take care of himself, you see, that he's going to shorten his life because he's going to make stupid decisions will affect him and will harm him.